Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Today on The Brian Lehrer Show, where does free speech end and the wisdom of restraint begin? After yesterday's shooting incident at a, quote, Muhammad cartoon contest sponsored by a conservative pro-Israel group, find the good guy in that story. We will get reaction from a staff writer at Charlie Hebdo, the French satirical magazine subjected to a terrorist attack. Are the magazine and this Pamela Geller group moral equivalents? And what about the MTA's new policy, banning all political and religious advertising on buses and subways to stop that same group from running ads deemed as anti-Islam? We'll talk about that. And it's commencement season. Now, last year saw at least three scheduled conservative speeches canceled after student and faculty protests, including Condoleezza Rice at Rutgers. Remember that? That speech did not take place. We'll talk to conservative writer Zev Chafetz, who has published a collection of conservative commencement addresses, all coming up. Plus, analysis of the criminal charges against six Baltimore cops in the death of Freddie Gray. But first, the criminal charges against high-ranking people in our local state governments. Bridgegate indictments on Friday in New Jersey, as you've heard. Charges against New York State Senate Majority Leader Dean Skelos expected today. WNYC and New Jersey Public Radio Christie correspondent Matt Katz is here, and WNYC's Andrea Bernstein, who roots around in the political muck on both sides of the George Washington Bridge.
Keep me very busy.
Hi, Andrea. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Brian.
Andrew, you first, because the new news today is that reportedly, at least, the U.S. attorney in Manhattan, Preet Bharara, will announce charges against State Senate Majority Leader Dean Skelos of Long Island and his son. Are you confident these charges are coming?
By all reports, I have no personal knowledge, but given the fact pattern that has been publicly reported, it would seem consistent that charges are indeed on their way, which is really a stunning turn of events.
What did they allegedly do?
So it's a complicated scheme, but basically it's that he and his son got a benefit circuitously for legislative favors, in essence, involving Nassau County, a non-lowest bidder to whom the son was a consultant. But the big picture of all of this is that for years and years and years in Albany, it was just completely acceptable to get financial benefit from being a high public official. And, you know, there's a sort of kind of mental rot that seeps in. Legislators feel we are public servants. We're here doing the public good. We are underpaid. They are steeped in money. All kinds of business people around them, lobbyists, have huge salaries. And there is a sort of sense in which sort of increasing justification comes along where people think, you know, if I'm getting a little bit here and there, who is it hurting? And it's, you know, it's hard to imagine how Albany brings itself to the end of its session with, you know, sort of two, you know, officials taken down, a brand new speaker, and Governor Cuomo still possibly under investigation himself.
Right. And I want to get back to the governor in a minute. But when Sheldon Silver, the assembly speaker, see, he was so identified with that position for so long that his title and his name blended into one. When Assembly Speaker Sheldon Silver was indicted earlier this year, he resigned his position as Speaker, and Carl Hastie from the Bronx rose to that position. Do you expect Skelos to give up the majority leader reins if, in fact, this indictment comes? And who would be a likely successor to that?
I honestly don't know, and I don't think that we will know until we see the charges. It was not clear immediately in Silver's case that he was going to resign until it was laid out what he was charged with, until the sort of reaction set in. But it's certainly – and then the number two Republican in Albany is also under federal investigation and has been charged with crime. So,
really?
I mean,
who is that?
That's, his name is Thomas Libos, an upstate figure. So, you know, it's sort of not clear who the leadership would go to. And, you know, I can only imagine people in Albany sort of scrambling to figure out how you govern. And, you know, it's so interesting because Preet Bharara, the U.S. attorney, has made it quite clear that he is going after the culture of corruption in Albany, and he is not going to stop until every last corruption weed is pulled out.
And Bharara is on fire here. Silver and now Skelos. Ever since Bharara got lit up by Governor Cuomo disbanding the Moreland Commission on Corruption last year before it finished some big investigations in order to make a political deal with Skelos, apparently, so that some other legislation could go through. So Bharara has got two of the so-called three men in the room who make all the decisions. Do we know that he's not also going to indict Cuomo himself for interfering with the Moreland Commission in some way that Bharara might assert was against the law? I know people have dismissed this and dismissed it and dismissed it as any kind of real possibility, but we see how aggressive this U.S. attorney is being.
I wouldn't rule anything out with Preet Bharara, and I think Governor Cuomo, by his behavior, is not ruling anything out. I mean, you know, he is no shrinking violet. He takes on all comers, and by which I mean the governor, is not aggressively going after the U.S. attorney and is, you know, sort of in his public statement saying, I'm not going to say anything until he's finished. So we just don't know. We honestly don't know. I mean, it's very, very hard to prove corruption cases. You know, we've seen what Cuomo's argument is, which was, this is my commission, therefore, how could I have interfered with it? So I'm sure that there's a lot of sort of U.S. attorneys arguing right now about whether there even is a possible crime committed there. But, you know, I think that it's worth remembering that, you know, this is a government that needs to function. And it has a system. And we are, you know, now in May, the session ends in June, all kinds of bills that have real impact on our lives.
Rent regulation.
Need to be passed.
Ethics reform, by the way.
I know, right? So,
so let's come back to that in a couple of minutes and rotate Matt Katz in here. And listeners, if you want to call on either of these things, the Bridgegate indictments on Friday or this reported indictment coming of the New York State Senate Majority Leader Dean Skelos today, and the larger context of that that our Andrea Bernstein was just describing, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. All right, Matt, Bridgegate, we know one of Governor Christie's Port Authority appointees, David Wildstein, pleaded guilty Friday to ordering lane closures at the George Washington Bridge on the first day of school and on 9/11, by the way, in 2013 as political payback for the mayor of Fort Lee not endorsing Christie for reelection. That motivation is in the indictment. And at 11 o'clock this morning, the other two being charged but pleading not guilty will be arraigned, Bill Baroni and former deputy chief of staff to the governor, Bridget Ann Kelly, who sent the famous email, "Time for some traffic problems in Fort Lee." But on Friday, she said this:
"I never ordered or conspired with David Wildstein to close or realign lanes at the bridge for any reason, much less for retribution."
Kelly defending herself in a statement she read to the press on Friday. So, Matt Katz, let me start here. If Kelly sent the email, "Time for some traffic problems in Fort Lee," and then poof, a few weeks later, traffic problems in Fort Lee, what's her further explanation going to be?
It seems to be that it was sarcasm, that she was joking, that and this is an interesting argument that I mean, I've thought so much about this and never thought of that as a possibility. Now, on one hand, you could say, oh, yeah, they had a beef with the mayor, and they talked about what they could do to get him back at him, joking around. It looks like time for some traffic problems in Fort Lee. The problem is with this argument that she was joking around. She called it a bad use of humor, a bad joke, insensitive. The problem is when Wildstein responded, "Got it," and when then 3 weeks later, the lanes actually closed. Then what happened? Did she say, whoa, I was just kidding. I didn't really mean that. I was joking around. These are questions that she'll have to answer in court. But that seems to be so far her argument. I think they're also going to, you know, frame Wildstein as this out of control liar. I mean, both Barone and Kelly's attorneys have called him a liar. So they're going to go after him, and they're hoping that Kelly presents her lawyers are that that Kelly presents herself very well in court. She's something of a sympathetic figure, they say. She lost her job. She was shamed in Christie's internal investigation as being emotional because Christie's campaign manager dumped her, and that's why she did this. She can't get new work. She's got four kids she's taking care of. She's divorced. She's very well, you know, poised. She did pretty well in front of the press on Friday when she spoke for the first time. And her attorney is hoping that that maybe can win over a jury.
And let me play a little bit of Bridget Ann Kelly kind of laying out that, if not point-by-point factual defense, this air of sympathy that she and her lawyer will try to make the case should develop around her. This is about a minute of Bridget Ann Kelly on Friday.
For over a year, I have remained quiet while many of the people whom I believed in, trusted, and respected have attempted to publicly discredit and even humiliate me. I am here today to say that I will no longer allow the lies that have been said about me or my role in the George Washington Bridge issue go unchallenged. Contrary to the way that I have been described by some of my former colleagues, I am not stupid. I am not weepy, insecure, unqualified, or overwhelmed. I believe I was, and still am, a very qualified, hardworking woman who took pride each and every day in being a loyal public employee.
Bridget Ann Kelly on Friday. And Andrea, the end of that was the most interesting part to me. Is this the feminist, I am a woman being persecuted for being a woman defense? Contrary to the way that I've been described by some of my former colleagues, I'm not stupid, I'm not weepy, insecure, unqualified, or overwhelmed. I believe I was and still am a very qualified, hardworking woman.
Well, I mean, this press conference that she held on Friday was it was very dramatic because, you know, it was sort of Bridget Ann Kelly speaks. It's like Garbo speaks. Like, we have never heard her speak. We have obviously, you know, we heard from Wildstein in court. We have heard from him through his emails. We saw him when he appeared before the legislature. We heard Bill Barone describe his version of events at length before the legislature. The U.S. attorney in New Jersey now says that that was part of the scheme. It was willfully and knowingly misleading. But we've never heard Bridget Ann Kelly. We've never even heard her voice. And she stood up there she had to actually stand on a little stool, like one of those things that you would have in your bathroom for your kid to be able
short?
To brush their teeth.
Is she
yes.
Very short?
So she stood up there and, you know, it sounded like, wow, like she is going to name names and she's going to say something. She did say in the press conference, it's ludicrous to think that I was the only one in the governor's office to know about the lane closures.
Wait, time out. Here it is.
For the indictment to suggest that I was the only person in the governor's office who was aware of the George Washington Bridge issue is ludicrous.
Ooh, that's so tantalizing.
Right, and the whole thing was so tantalizing because it did, well, you know, she comes out and she sort of has this kind of I am woman, hear me roar beginning, which is a response to the Mastro report, which is the report that was done by the governor's lawyer back in I guess about over a year ago now, last year in March, in which they said that she had a relationship with the campaign manager that had gone awry and was sort of widely viewed as the slut-shaming of Bridget Ann Kelly, that somehow she was so upset about this failed relationship that she closed down the bridge. And so she stood up and answered that. It did sound like she had more to say, and she didn't take questions. Her attorney did. And we tried to say, well, okay, who was she with when she sent the time for some traffic problems in Fort Lee? And was there anybody who told her to say that? And was there anybody who instructed her to delete emails? And it became clear that whatever she knows is going to have to be saved for another forum. But, you know, she clearly does not want to go to jail. Matt was saying, mother of four, you know, I think her oldest is about ready for college, and she doesn't want to be behind bars. So unlike David Wildstein, who, you know, he could, I mean, he might go to jail. We don't know. David Wildstein might go to jail, but Bridget N. Kelly is sort of going for the I am going for broke, no jail time.
Because Matt Katzen, I want to be very clear on this point, one could see how it might be in Bridget N. Kelly's to make some kind of a plea deal with the prosecutor here and flip. If she's going to tantalizingly put that out there and she seems ready at some point to name names about who else in the governor's office would have known about the plot to close these lanes at the George Washington Bridge, then why not do it, get this off her back? Hopefully this is not the kind of charge, from her point of view, hopefully, not the kind of charge that would actually land her behind bars as not a violent criminal, and get this monkey off her back. Why not?
Well, and also, why hasn't she – well, the real question, I think, is why hasn't she done that so far? If she really was able to implicate somebody else in the governor's office, perhaps somebody above her, then – she would have already, you would think that she would have already cut that deal with the U.S. attorney. Now, Christie's people have parsed that statement that she made. And if we drill into it a little bit here, she said it's ludicrous that I was the only one who knew about the lane closures in the governor's office. And of course, other people in the governor's office knew about the lane closures. What she didn't say is that I was the only one who knew the lane closures were due to a political retaliation scheme, not due to a traffic study. The governor's office folks have said all along that they knew about the lane closures. They knew that there was a traffic jam, a multi-day traffic jam. They just say it was because they thought it was a legitimate traffic study.
Right.
So if you parse her statement there, you know, maybe she doesn't have more information. I don't know. I mean, uh-huh. You know, Wildstein's lawyers have also teased it. Wildstein's lawyer has said from the get-go that evidence exists to indicate that Governor Christie knew about the lane closures. And we don't know if that means the famous picture that many of us have now seen of Wildstein and Christie hanging out at Ground Zero on September 11th, one of the days of the lane closures. Is that the evidence that exists? So both of these folks have, you know, floated these tantalizing ideas that they may have more information, but so far they haven't delivered it. And, and why haven't they given it to the U.S. attorney?
And again, knowing about the lane closures on the part of the governor is different than being in on a plot to close the lanes as political payback for the mayor of Fort Lee not endorsing Christie for re-election. I want to take a phone call because we're getting a caller, I think, on the sarcasm defense from Bridget N. Kelly, and it is Kevin in Morris Plains. Kevin, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. You know, the sarcasm is just endemic in his whole organization because I think Matt played the clip months and months ago of Christie actually saying, oh, yeah, I know all about that. I was the guy with the orange vest that was moving the cones.
In response to a question by you, Matt, right?
That's right. Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah, the sarcasm. The governor is very sarcastic in his responses when he doesn't think that a question should be asked of him. And obviously, that's become the most famous example. But I hadn't made that connection that Kelly's using a sarcasm argument as well.
Kevin, you're saying it's plausible because of the amount of sarcasm that they tend to use in their speech around there, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, I would love if I was Matt, I would love the next time I see the governor say, "When are you going to apologize for the to the mayor and the residents and the people that were affected. Now, I know you had nothing to do with Hurricane Sandy, but you were very compassionate to all those people. When are you going to exhibit some compassion to the people in Fort Lee that were affected?
Well, Kevin, thank you. Forgive me, I'm going to move on for time. But, Matt, he did do kind of an apology tour to Fort Lee, the governor, didn't he?
Yeah, he went all the way to Fort Lee and apologized to the mayor. And actually, in that first press conference he did, he didn't initially apologize. But I did actually ask him that on that first day, and he did end up apologizing for what happened, because he said, "I ultimately bear responsibility on behalf of the administration." But notably, he hasn't since. Friday he released a statement on Twitter saying, "This proves I had nothing to do with anything," but he has not been contrite about, the fact that, folks in Fort Lee still feel like they got, a really raw deal of that week in September 13th.
And as we talk about criminal charges on both sides of the George Washington Bridge today, we can now confirm with the Associated Press and the New York Times both reporting that the leader of the New York State Senate has surrendered to face charges including extortion and soliciting bribes amid a federal investigation into the awarding of a $12 million contract to a company that hired his son. The AP says FBI officials said Republican Dean Skelos of Long Island surrendered at the Bureau's office in Manhattan at about 9:30 this morning. Skelos said last month he was cooperating fully and would not resign his leadership post.
Well, I mean, it comes as no surprise. I mean, I do think Silver also said initially he wasn't going to resign his post. So I think that there's sort of, we have to see what happens. And again, hear the details of the charges.
Preet Bharara, the U.S. attorney, has now scheduled a news conference for noon, we are told. So we will find out more as today goes on.
So I think that what is just so interesting is, we were talking about the culture of corruption that Preet Bharara said he was going after. It was the opposite in New Jersey, 100 degrees of difference between Paul Fishman and Preet Bharara, two U.S. attorneys, both working for the same Justice Department right across the Hudson. Paul Fishman was said, is there a culture of corruption or is there a culture in Trenton that allowed these closures to take place? And he said, I don't do culture. And, I asked him, well, how come Bridget Ann Kelly, Bill Baroni, David Wildstein, they were not the beneficiaries of this scheme. They were not personally going to benefit. They were mad that he wasn't endorsing their boss. And, so why are they the criminals? And, he sort of said, well, there's a lot of precedent in federal law for third-party beneficiaries, but you can see the difference in the approach that he really was staying within the four corners of his indictment. He wouldn't say anything. And, the sort of question that I think everybody wants to answer is, was there something that was systemically wrong in Trenton that allowed this to happen, even if the governor knew nothing, was duped by everybody else? Is there some problem there? And you think about the way that Preet Bharara has commented on Albany.
On the corruption of culture of corruption in Albany.
And Paul Fishman was like, that's not my job. And finally, at the end of the press conference, I said to him, well, are we ever going to read in a history book what Christie knew and when he knew it? And he said, well, that's an interesting question, but I'm not a historian, so I'm not going to answer it. So such a different tone between the two. And, I have to say about these tantalizing hints that are being dropped, Paul Fishman made clear that he is pretty much done. I mean, he said further evidence could come out. He sort of left that little door open. But it's hard to imagine after a year and a half investigation, he hasn't established that there's not something that Bridget Ann Kelly or David Wildstein could tell him
about Christie.
Christie that would make him want to move on. So,
Matt Katz, the next question becomes political. And that is the culture, the tone that Christie may have set that led his employees to do this kind of thing on his behalf enough to harm him in the presidential race?
I read a quote from somebody in New Hampshire, from a voter in New Hampshire this weekend, who said that, you know, this indicates that people who worked for him were so passionate about him that they were willing to close the lanes of the busiest bridge in the world on his behalf. On the other hand, all of this does confirm this stereotype that seems to vaguely exist out there in the country, that people in the state play too hard, they play too tough, they play too dirty, and it's going to be a push and pull on those two dynamics. Is he just does he just breed a sort of aggressive loyalty, or is he allow an environment of dirtiness to exist in his realm in order to, in some sort of larger Machiavellian motivation that he has? I think voters are going to have to decide that. I'm headed to New Hampshire later in the week to try to take the temperature of folks up there. New Hampshire is the do-or-die state for him right now. He really has to win that if he's going to be competitive in a presidential race. But as far as I heard from Christie people talking to them this weekend, the plan is to still move toward running for president sometime between Memorial Day and July 4th. This was not what happened on Friday did not derail that. I will also want to make one more point, because we've discussed him many times on this program. Bill Stepien, Christie's former campaign manager, the guy who was supposed to run Christie's presidential campaign, uh-huh, who was fired by Christie, was notably not charged on Friday. And that could lead credence to this argument that there was not a culture of retaliation there, that this did not come from the top down, from the top echelons of the campaign, that it was really just a rogue operation. I thought that was sort of an undercovered but significant development on Friday. It still doesn't explain why the governor necessarily fired him, because there was no evidence indicating that he was directly involved in the scheme. But I thought that was notable. I don't think he'll be running the presidential campaign for Christie, though. I think he's still on the outs.
The Wildstein Wilding defense on the campaign trail. Andrea, last word. You've been our national political correspondent. You followed the candidates around the country in 2008. Does Christie still get in? And you know New Hampshire. Will this affect him there, because he's now the wrong kind of Republican?
Yeah, I do. You know, it's interesting, because as much as I know about Bridgegate and as much time as I've spent thinking about it, I do not rule Chris Christie out. These races are very unpredictable. There are a lot of shifts in who the leader is. The Jeb Bush juggernaut has not taken off in the way that Team Jeb Bush was sort of hoping that it would, and publicly expressing. And I think that, you know, the advantage for Christie, what I think has always been the sort of underpinning rationale, is it seems like what Christie is saying makes so much sense, that he's so clear, that he's so straightforward. And in that way, he's kind of the anti-Obama. Obama may be making perfect sense, but it frequently sounds like he isn't. And with Christie, it may be the obverse, but nevertheless, there's that sort of refreshing, and voters tend to like something refreshing and something different. So that is goes to his favor.
Right, that was his original storyline.
Right. It's like, you know, can he make them love him? And, you know, in the New York Times in the last year, we've seen since November, we've seen headlines saying Chris Christie is back and Chris Christie's presidential hopes fade. Politics loves a redemption song. So I think we're not done yet.
And by the way, for clarification and technical accuracy, I will point out that Skelos has not been indicted technically. This is a criminal complaint, which for all practical purposes, folks out there, is the same thing. He's being charged.
It was the same process with Silver, and then he was
indicted. But he will be formally indicted later. But this is a criminal complaint today. Now it's official against the majority leader of the New York State Senate, Republican Dean Skelos of Long Island. WNYC investigative reporter Andrea Bernstein and our Christie tracker, Matt Katz, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Brian.
And, of course, a lot more on our website on both of these things at WNYC.org. But coming up next, analysis of the criminal charges against six Baltimore cops in the death of Freddie Gray.